Stevens has joined. We'll hear arguments first this morning in Block against Neal. Mr. Phillips.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. This is a suit arising under the Federal Tort Claims Act, and specifically the issue is whether a suit against the United States alleging that a federal employee negligently inspected a home purchased from a private developer but with federal monies is a claim arising out of a misrepresentation and therefore barred under the Federal Tort Claims Act, specifically Section 2680H of the Act. The Farmers Home Administration is an agency of the Department of Agriculture, which, among other services, provides loans to low-income rural housing residents to assist them in purchasing safe and decent housing. In 1977, the Farmers Home Administration granted respondents' application for a loan. And respondent then entered into a contract with a private developer, the name of the company, the Home Marketing Associates, Inc., to purchase a prefabricated house. The purchase price of the house was approximately $21,000. During the construction of the house and in accordance with Farmers Home Administration regulations, a county employee of the administration inspected the house when it was 2% completed, 99% completed, and 100% completed. On each occasion, she signed an inspection report indicating that there were no major deviations from the housing plans and specifications that she discovered in her inspection. Each inspection lasted between 10 and 30 minutes. Ms. Wells and respondent both participated in the final inspection, and respondent signed the final inspection. 2 months after respondent moved into her house, she notified the Farmers Home Administration that she was having difficulties with the heat pump that had been installed.
It really wasn't much of an inspection, was it?
No, sir. It was not the best inspection that one could have hoped for. A second inspector went out to the house and discovered that the heat pump that had been installed was not the same heat pump that had been provided in the plans and specifications, that it was indeed a significantly smaller heat pump than they had anticipated, made by a different manufacturer. In addition, that inspector discovered other defects in the house that are listed in the respondent's brief. Efforts by the Farmers Home Administration to convince the Home Marketing Associates company to correct these defects proved unsuccessful for reasons that do not appear on the record. When respondent failed to get satisfaction or to receive satisfaction from the farmers from the company, she filed suit in state court against the Secretary of Agriculture, the head of the Farmers Home Administration, various employees of the Farmers Home Administration in the United States. That suit was removed to federal court, and the district court granted the government's motion to dismiss the complaint for failure to state a claim. The theory of the district court was essentially that the statute and regulations created no duty running to the respondent to guarantee the quality of the house based on the inspections that had been undertaken. The Sixth Circuit on appeal agreed with the district court with regard to the contract theory. It found nothing in the statute, regulations, or conduct of the Farmers Home Administration that would create any kind of a contractual duty that to warrant the quality of the house. The Court of Appeals, however, reversed on the tort issue. It held that the government's inspection could legitimately be regarded as having violated the Good Samaritan Doctrine. The Good Samaritan Doctrine requires someone who acts on behalf of another and engenders reliance from that other person to exercise due care and to be responsible for any injuries caused by the failure to exercise due care. In addition, the Court held that the respondent's claim regarding negligent inspection was not barred by the misrepresentation exception.
Mr. Phillips, you referred two or three times to the claim as one claiming a negligent inspection. Actually, the claim was involved a breach of the duty to supervise as well as to inspect, didn't it?
Well, the problem with that is that there's nothing specific in the complaint with regard to exactly what they meant by supervision. The only supervision of the construction, Justice Rehnquist, was in the inspection of the house.
Well, but the complaint never went to trial, and under the federal rules, you presumably are entitled to adduce any number of facts in support of even a generally pleaded allegation. The Court of Appeals certainly referred to it. It says failure to provide technical assistance, including inspection, supervision of construction.
But that's only if there's something in the statute that would provide for supervision in addition to the inspection.
I realize
nothing in the statute to that effect. So that at issue, the only thing that could potentially be alleged and be consistent with the statute is a negligent inspection.
Well, you say that even the 1949 Act then doesn't authorize or require the government to supervise as opposed to inspect.
That's correct, Your Honor. I mean, the only supervision that's discussed is supervised loans and the provision of information to the respondent, so that even to the extent that supervision is alleged here, it's still all based on the exchange of information. And that exchange of information is what this court held in Newstead is barred under the misrepresentation exception.
Mr. Phillips,
Well, following up on this point, then, if I may, what does Section 1476A mean, then, when it says buildings and repairs constructed with funds advanced pursuant to this subchapter shall be supervised and inspected as required by the Secretary?
Well, I mean, as required by the Secretary, nothing that we have specifically requires us to do more supervision of the construction. We do supervise to the extent that we provide plans and general architectural information to contractors that we hope that we expect that they will follow, and we follow that up by inspecting the house to try to see that there is some conformity between the plans and the way the house is developed.
And it's your position that the Secretary has never authorized any supervision of construction?
Not in the way that would be anything other than by that would be covered, that not in any way that is not covered under the misrepresentation exception to the Tort Claims Act.
And Section 1822.7, which says supervision will be provided borrowers to the extent necessary to achieve the objectives of the loan and to protect the interests of the government.
Sure, because that still is supervision of the borrowers. We don't supervise construction. It's not as though the government assumes the position of foreman for home marketing associates. We go out and we inspect it. That's the primary method by which we supervise. There is additional supervision in that we supervise the loan to make sure that the monies are spent properly. And there is additional information, and the provision of architectural services is a form of supervision. But it's all of that, I submit, is supervision that would be barred under the misrepresentation exception if there's a basis for it.
Are you arguing that the government has, under the laws established here, no duty to the owner of the home? That the law creates no duty in this area?
Well, I mean, that's what the district court held, and the
was that your position?
We did not argue that in this case. It would be my position that we owe no specific duty to the respondent in this case. That's correct.
Under the law.
Under the law. That while we do, I mean, there's no, the regulations provide general obligations to act, but the only duty that would ever occur would have to come out of state law. And that, we say, is
well, how
to
about
the extent
the federal
that duty would have
existed. Do you think that the federal law indicates that there is no intention by Congress to benefit the homeowner by these services?
No, that is not our submission. We recognize, just as a new stat, that this statute is designed to provide some benefits. I mean, almost all federal statutes are designed to benefit individual citizens. This is one of them. The primary purpose of this statute we have submitted is to protect the government's security interest. In doing that, we will, in most instances, also protect the homeowner. But that's only incidental to what I submit as our primary mission, at least as interpreted by the Farmers Home Administration, which is a reasonable interpretation of the statute and the regulations.
And there's no secondary duty.
Well, no secondary duty that would give rise to any kind of tort liability.
But if the government is responsible or assumes responsibility for anything like architectural supervision, mm-hmm. that certainly is the thrust of that sort of liability if they fail to perform. It isn't misrepresentation at all. If you're an owner and hire an architect, mm-hmm. and the architect defaults on his obligation to supervise, the gist of your claim against him isn't that he didn't tell you that a lot of things were bad in the place, it's that he didn't have them fixed.
Well, I agree. We recognize that there's a difference between misrepresentation and various forms of malpractice. But all we're saying here, I mean, we didn't hire an architect of any sort. What we did was we had an architect draw up plans that would be usable for all rural residents, and we have a variety of those plans that exist, and we just hope that they would be followed. That's all.
I thought you identified the question in the case of whether the United States has waived sovereign immunity for this kind of a tort action.
Yes, Your Honor.
So you, whether you owed a duty or not, or whether you broke it, is irrelevant to that question.
Well, that is correct, except that under the under this Court's decision in the United States versus Neustadt, the way the analysis should run is first whether the basic activities of the government are within the misrepresentation exception, which we submit means an inspection which may be negligently performed, followed by certification of some fact, followed by injury. That's what the misrepresentation exception is designed to deal with. This Court went further and said it could well be that even though this is within the misrepresentation exception, there could be some there may have been indications in the 34 Act at issue there that for some reason Congress intended to supersede the misrepresentation exception. And respondents have seized on differences between the 34 Act and the 49 Act to suggest that that secondary analysis in Neustadt satisfied in this case. Our position is that there is nothing different in the 49 Act and the 34 Act. It's clear that Congress did not intend for the government to warrant the quality of the respondent's house in this case. As we have, maybe going over some ground, but Section 1346 obviously provides a general waiver of the government's sovereign immunity. The exception that we're concerned with here is for misrepresentations. Our submission is that the decision of the Sixth Circuit is fundamentally inconsistent with the decision of this Court in United States versus Neustadt.
Mr. Phillips, let's assume for a minute that the complaint did allege something beyond misrepresentation, alleged that there was a duty on the part of the agency to force the builder to fix the home by some means, and the complaint alleges that. Now, is that obligation of the government, in your position, a discretionary act by the government?
You mean within the meaning of
the
Section
government
2688?
Has discretion? Mm-hmm.
Well, I would guess, I mean, it seems fairly clear. It depends on how the regulation would be stated, I guess. If there were a regulation in this case that said that the government must discover every defect and must make every defect corrected before any monies will be released, then it would seem to me we would be hard-pressed to argue that that's a discretionary decision because the regulation will have essentially taken away all of our discretion. But if the regulation merely suggests that we should have inspections and there is some general possibility that we might withhold money depending on the circumstances, then it would seem clearly to be within the discretionary function exception.
What do they require? Is it discretionary or not?
Well, I think it would clearly be discretionary. There is nothing in the regulations. I mean, I think it's important to realize in this case that the respondent has received reimbursement for the heat pump and other major structural defects in this house under an administrative program. And the only defects we're talking about now are essentially cosmetic defects. It is inconceivable, and there is nothing in the regulations that would provide to the contrary, that Congress anticipated that we would hold up all loan monies for the correction of all potential cosmetic defects in a house. As we suggest in our brief, and I don't believe respondents denied, there is no new house that I've ever known and that anyone has known and that the contractor, even in this case, in his testimony, had ever seen that doesn't have some problems in it. And it can't be that the government will be responsible to correct all of those. And that's why there is nothing in the regs. So clearly, there is some discretion. You would release money and expect that the contractor would make good on it.
Mr. Phillips, you're not suggesting there's discretion to make a negligent inspection, are you?
Well,
assuming there were a duty to inspect, I understand you deny there's such duty running to the borrower, but assuming there were a duty to inspect, would it not be a duty to inspect with due care?
If this were a private person who undertook, there is no development factually of what's went on here, we don't deny that it's certainly possible that a private inspector could be held to a duty to exercise due care under the Good Samaritan doctrine.
If we accept the allegation of the complaint, must we not assume, maybe it's not true, that the inspection was conducted negligently?
Well, that's right, and we don't dispute that.
And had the inspection been conducted properly, they would have discovered the defect and they wouldn't have paid for the heat pump.
Well, but, I mean, that's just as true under United States versus Newstat. I mean, in that case, they said if the government
goes to the issue of misrepresentation. We're now talking about...
You want to ignore the misrepresentation.
I
would be prepared to concede for purposes of this argument that that's right. There would be a duty, and that would have been a violation of the duty. We don't have any quarrel with the court, at least in here now, with the Sixth Circuit's holding that this might well violate the Good Samaritan Doctrine. Our submission is obviously that it is also a misrepresentation, and therefore...
Prior to 1946, would there have been any action sustainable against the government prior to the Tort Claims Act?
No, Your Honor.
And the Tort Claims Act, did it waive all sovereign immunity, or did it have some exceptions?
It has a very lengthy set of exceptions.
For governmental functions, primarily discretionary governmental functions.
That's correct, Section 2680A.
But again, you're not relying on that in this case.
No, we don't rely
on the
discretionary
relying on
the
misrepresentation.
That's correct, Your Honor. Our position here is that there is no that this Court cannot affirm the holding of the Sixth Circuit without overruling its prior decision in United States versus Newstat, and that it would be wholly inappropriate to do that. Newstat involves simply an interpretation of Section 2680H, a provision that Congress enacted in 1946 and has allowed to remain in effect since 1961 when this Court decided Newstat. If its feeling was that the interpretation of this Court was improper or unduly restricted the rights of recovery of individuals in respondents' position, we could only presume that it would have changed it. Instead, what Congress has done is, one, passed additional legislation providing for inspections on the relying upon this Court's decision in Newstat, and more fundamentally has passed 42 U.S.C. Section 1797C in this case.
You which, find no difference in the two acts, the one involved in Neustadt and this one?
No difference that would make any kind of a difference to take the case out of the misrepresentation exception. I don't believe that anything in the 1949 Act provides any stronger basis for arguing that the government has warranted the quality of the house. And that is the only thing that I can understand the Court to have meant in the second part of its holding in Newstat. Because otherwise, I mean, it's within the misrepresentation exception, but it may be that the government went ahead and warrants the house. But the 49 Act makes clear that that was not the intention. And no other court has ever held that it was the intention. No court in reviewing the legislative history has indicated that Congress intended to warrant the quality of all of these houses.
Is there a difference that Newstat, the misrepresentation was made before the purchase and it was made after the purchase?
Well, there is some dispute about that, and nothing in the record indicates precisely when the check was delivered to the respondent in this case. The employees of the Farmers Home Administration have informed us that while the check was formally dispersed from the Farmers Home Administration central office on the date listed in the joint appendix,
That's not in the record.
No, Your Honor, that is not in the record. To the extent you're interested in the extra record facts, the check was handed over.
I didn't say I was interested in facts outside the record.
Okay, Your Honor. What we can say, I think, is that it is inconceivable that the Farmers Home Administration would hand over a check without having it made its final inspection. And therefore, we believe it's a fair inference from all of the circumstances to conclude that we didn't actually send the check away until after we had engaged in the final inspection. At least that is the standard practice, and there's no reason to doubt that it was deviated from in this case.
Suppose the inspection had not been made at all. What would be your position?
Well, the regulations don't actually require us. My recollection is that the regulations suggest that we make inspections at various times. I would guess that if it turned out that the Farmers Home Administration had good reason that it simply was not in a position to inspect a house at the times that it had to, that would not violate the regulations. The most we would do is tell her that we were having some difficulty. But I don't see that would create any cause of action. Again, tort liability.
That's essentially this case, isn't it?
I'm sorry?
That's essentially this case. It's true she went out, but her testimony on the stand was rather devastating. She wasn't trained. She didn't know what to do on an inspection and didn't inspect and filled out the papers.
Well, she looked through the house. I don't know what... I mean, presumably any kind of obvious defects in the house could have been discovered even with that kind of an inspection. It's not likely that she would have been able to discover whether the proper manufacturer's name appeared on the heat pump based on the kind of inspection we're talking about.
Well, someone else went out later and discovered all kinds of things.
But there's an inherent advantage if somebody's been living in the house for 2 months and has started to use the house and the dwelling. You find out things as you go along. It's simply not reasonable to expect the government, even if we had the best inspectors in the world and took time, it's most unlikely we would discover every conceivable defect in a house prior to the moving in of the, or prior to the final settlement of the house. This court in the United States versus Neustadt made plain what I think is the proper approach in these cases. The question is, it recognized that the traditional common law rule of misrepresentation recognized a tort in the situation where there is an inspection, followed by a certification of a fact, followed by injury and reliance on that fact. And that is precisely what is involved in this case, and the misrepresentation exception should be applied in this case just as it was in Neustadt. I think it's important to realize that this is not an overreaching use of the sovereign immunity doctrine. The respondent has received recovery. The Congress provided for her under an administrative relief program that was adopted in clear recognition that she would not have recovery under the Federal Tort Claims Act because of this Court's decision in Neustadt. And in order to hold as the Sixth Circuit did, it would have to be an absolute disregard of that enactment. We submit that's incorrect. We ask this Court to reverse that judgment. If there are no other questions, I would reserve the balance of my time.
Very well. Mr. Crose.
Chief Justice, may it please the Court. Despite the government's attempt to torture the allegations in the complaint in this case to fit the misrepresentation exception to the Tort Claims Act, this case was not, is not, and cannot be a case that arises out of misrepresentation. First, I will state the bases of Ms. Neal's claim. And then secondly, I will show that the relationship and conduct of the parties created a duty of care running from Farmer's home to Ms. Neal. Ms. Neal asserts in her complaint that Farmer's home employees negligently planned and supervised the construction of her home. This claim included the following omissions and commissions.
Mr. Chris, are you reading from the complaint now, or summarizing?
I'm not reading from the complaint. The complaint alleged negligent planning and supervision of her home, and that they breached a duty of care to her in exercising those activities.
And then you're about to go into a list of the omissions. Are those contained in the complaint?
Those are contained in the factual allegations of the complaint, which preceded the cause of action, the statement of a cause of action. First, that Farmer's Home failed to recommend and approve a reputable and competent builder. The complaint alleges that the builder was disbarred subsequently, and the depositions had attached to a letter which showed that the builder had 9 other complaints against it, not just Ms. Neal. Secondly, that the officials failed to obtain accurate and complete plans for Ms. Neal's home. In the complaint, we allege they received a totally different set of plans than what they were supposed to be for Ms. Neal, and that those plans didn't have any plans for the heating and cooling duct system. Third, that the Farmer's home did not properly review the plans and specifications of Ms. Neal's home. Ms. Wells admitted she didn't look at the plans. Fourth, that the Farmer's home did not properly supervise the expenditure of Ms. Neal's loan proceeds. There was money paid out before the first inspection was made. Farmer's home failed to detect defects in Ms. Neal's home. That's quite evident. They failed to reject defective work and materials or to require their correction. Finally, they failed to carefully inspect her home. Out of this extensive negligent conduct, which lasted over a period of months and involved several Farmer's home employees, the government extracts out one single inspection report and seeks to rely upon it to deny Ms. Neal her day in court. An examination of the facts alleged in the complaint and gleaned from the record here shows that the gravamen of Ms. Neal's complaint is negligence, not misrepresentation. We must review the conduct and relationship and the transaction between the parties. When we do, that shows that a duty that Farmers Home undertook activities which they had a duty to perform with due care. In 1976, Ms. Neal was a 48-year-old cafeteria worker in a local elementary school. The home she was living in was falling down around her, literally. She didn't make much money, a little over $3,000 a year. When she couldn't find a house which she could afford herself, she went to the lender of last resort, her local Farmers Home and Administration office. Ms. Neal filled out an application. She was certified eligible. Ms. Neal was referred by the county supervisor to a local builder of prefabricated homes. They reviewed plans which purported to be for her home. They supplied a form construction contract which had a special clause in it, which gave Farmers Home the right to inspect, test, and examine materials and to reject defective materials and require correction. Before construction began, she executed a promissory note to pay back the loan. She executed a deed of trust to secure the note. And then the proceeds were put in a supervised account, which required not only her signature, but an official's from Farmers Home signature to release the funds. Three disbursements were made. The last one that we know of was made on September 30th. And then they made three on-site inspections, the last one occurring on October 3rd. Now, after she moved into the house, she discovered things weren't right. She didn't have any heat. The ducts were falling apart. Plumbing had 90-degree bends in it. She couldn't find her water heater. Concrete block foundation had blocks missing.
What time of year did she move in, does the complaint say?
What time did she move
in? What time of year did she move in?
She moved in sometime in October, Judge Justice Rufus.
Couldn't she figure out the minute she moved in that she didn't have any heat?
Your Honor, that was not in the record. And I can answer your question. Whenever the confusion came up by when the exact payment was made, I said, we never did find out when you moved in, Ms. Neal. I called her up. She said, well, I had to move in October 1st because the owner of the house I was in was tearing it down and said I had to be out before October 1st. The house presently is not even now fastened to the foundation, and there's no exterior sheathing which provides any moisture barrier, which subjects the house to weather conditions. To say that these activities undertaken by Farmers Home engender no reliance and created no duty of care simply defies common sense. She couldn't find housing. She couldn't afford it. She didn't have much education. She went to Farmers Home for help. They took her application. They checked her credit. They determined what amount she could pay back. They determined how much of a house she could get. They set the minimum standards. They set the maximum payments. They engendered total reliance upon them to supply the means, the know-how, the supervision, and inspections needed to provide Ms. Neal safe and decent housing. This relationship between Farmers Home and only a Neal and the extent of the supervision and control they exercised necessarily engendered reliance by Ms. Neal upon Farmers Home.
Mr. Kroos, under your theory, do you suppose that when the federal government, through its agencies, inspects a toy or a drug, for example, to determine whether the product is safe and then declares it safe, that someone later injured because in fact it's unsafe has a cause of action under your theory against the government?
Well, first, I want to make one thing clear, Justice O'Connor. This is not an inspection case. It's a negligence case. In order to establish a claim for negligence, you must determine whether or not there's a duty of care running from the government to the injured party. That depends upon the relationship of the parties, the conduct and control exercised by the government to prevent the injury, and the foreseeability of it. It's certainly foreseeable in the fact situation you gave that a purchaser of defective toy would be harmed. And if the government had control over that process, it may very well. I think the weakness in that case is the first criteria, and that is a relationship. In this case, Farmers Home, Ms. Neal, had a direct one-to-one relationship which was clearly dependent. The question becomes whether or not that particular factor in the fact situation you suggest is strong enough to impose a duty.
It's your position that Ms. McNeal had no responsibility at all?
No, Your Honor, but the actions by the Farmers Home Administration and the extensiveness of it barred her or precluded her from seeking outside help. She assumed that Farmers Home was going to take care of everything. I think it prevented her. I mean,
how?
Because they gave her, by their conduct and activities, that she was going
to... She could have gotten a good inspection made and paid for it, couldn't she? Could she?
Yes. Yes, assuming she had the money.
Well,
but
then
the fact,
you do say that the whole basis is she had no responsibility.
The response, I don't say that. I think her responsibility would be conditioned upon what Farmers Home undertook or didn't undertake.
And
if they undertook what they did, she necessarily relied upon them to exercise due care.
And she had no responsibility.
That's correct. This case does not violate or conflict with any of the holdings in Neustadt or Indian Towing. In Indian Towing, this case is like Indian Towing because a duty of care was ran from Farmers Home to Only O'Neill, and that duty of care arises out of Farmers Home undertaking of services. If a private party had undertaken to provide Ms. Neal the services which Farmers Home undertook and engendered the kind of reliance with Farmers Home engendered, that person would be obligated to use due care. If that party failed in its duty of care and damages resulted, liability would be found. Unlike Neustadt, the inspection report relied upon by the government is not an essential element to sustain Ms. Neal's cause of action. You could take away this inspection report and delete it from the record, and Ms. Neal would still have a cause of action. If you took away the appraisal report in the Neustadt case, Mr. Neustadt simply does not have a cause of action. In conclusion, and I'm going to be brief here, it is important to keep in mind three considerations. First, Ms. Neal is not asking this court to hold Farmers Home liable. What she is asking is that she have an opportunity to prove her claim in court. Given a colorable claim of negligence, which she has clearly demonstrated, she should be entitled to pursue her claim before a trier of fact. If she had been given this opportunity...
Mr. Close, do you think either the Sixth Circuit or the District Court in this case passed on the question of whether her allegations, apart from the inspection theory, stated a claim against the government?
Yes, I think the Court of Appeals clearly saw that we were talking more than just merely an inspection report. We were talking about all the activities that Farmers Home undertook for her.
Well, I don't read in the Sixth Circuit's opinion any specific pronouncement one way or the other about whether if you prove these facts, the government under either the 34 Act or the 49 Act did have an obligation imposed by statute to perform these services.
It's our contention that the statute 506 and the regulations under that statute clearly impose upon Farmers Home an obligation to supervise and inspect.
I
don't think that's really material, because whether or not Farmers Home perform those services under its statutory obligation or regulatory obligation or voluntarily undertook them, the fact is that they did. The crucial question...
part of your complaint is not only that there was a duty that to supervise that was breached, but that there was the duty of supervision was undertaken, whether required by law or not, and that on the Good Samaritan theory was negligently performed.
That's correct. The crucial thing for the negligence claim is whether or not there was a duty of care. And the duty of care only arises under principles of common law. And in this case, the principle of common law applied is the voluntary undertaking doctrine. If Ms. Neal had been given her opportunity to present her claim before a trier of fact, this court and the parties could have avoided some of the confusion which has arisen regarding some of the facts. This confusion and misstatement is probably inevitable in light of the fact that there was no trial finding the fact or record, a complete record produced. We feel it would be inappropriate for this court to issue an opinion which may have important consequences to tort law and federal housing policy on the basis of an incomplete record. Secondly, the government's assertion that Ms. Neal's claim is really misrepresentation is a red herring. The facts alleged in the complaint, and which are contained in the record, cannot support the government's contention. If the Farmers' Home interpretation of the misrepresentation exception prevails, the Tort Claims Act itself would be emasculated. What was intended by Congress to be a narrow exception would in fact swallow the act. And it would block legitimate claims by aggrieved citizens whenever there was communication in any form. And this is the precise opinion which this court rejected in Indian Towing.
Neustadt began swallowing the act in this direction, didn't it?
We believe it did to a certain extent insofar as courts have had difficulty drawing the line in the continuum between negligence and negligent misrepresentation. It's our position that there are three factors, and they're all factual findings which must be made. You have to look at the relationship of the parties, the conduct of the parties, and the foreseeability. In those three areas, you have to look to see whether or not this is, in fact, misrepresentation or negligence. Finally, the government and Congress, under the Title V of the 1949 Housing Act, create a program to assist low-income residents in the country to obtain decent and safe housing. This purpose of the act is being frustrated by the negligent acts of the agency charged with this responsibility. We contend that a farmer's home is permitted to deny Ms. Neal her day in court. In this case, she and the borrowers like her would be denied any opportunity to complain that Farmers Home, by the negligence of its own employees, has violated a fundamental purpose of the rural housing program. Farmers Home would be able to finance construction of the very unsafe substandard homes which it is supposed to replace. It is important to note that the government has made a contention that the administrative relief under the 509C program creates some kind of exclusive remedy. First of all, the 509C program created a remedy in order to get the program back on track. In other words, Congress perceived there were problems, primarily because adequate inspections weren't being made. However, there's nothing in the statute, nothing in the legislative history which suggests that Congress intended to cut off or substitute a remedy in lieu of the one provided under the FTCA. In essence, Congress didn't contemplate whether or not there was the existence or non-existence of any remedy under the Federal Tort Claim Act. Finally, the fear of vast financial liability is more properly addressed to Congress. Secondly, there has been no factual support of this vast fear. Farmers Home can exercise greater care in approving builders. It can require construction bonds. It can conduct more careful inspections. It can be more rigorous in requiring contractors to correct shoddy construction. And in fact, the claims paid out under the 509 program has declined between 1981 and 1982 from 292 claims to 106. Doesn't look to me that there is this vast financial liability lurking out there. Ms. Neal has sufficiently alleged negligence by Farmers Home employees. She is entitled to pursue her claim by trial. And we ask that the judgment of the Court of Appeals be affirmed.
Let me ask you just one additional question. Did the parties in the proceedings below have any occasion to discuss the application of Section 2680A of the Tort Claims Act, that possible exclusion?
No, Justice O'Connor.
Thank
it
you.
Wasn't raised in any of the courts below.
Do you have anything further, Mr. Phillips?
Yes, Mr. Chief Justice, just briefly. The respondent's submission details a long series of problems with this house, and we don't deny that there are problems with her house. But what that submission does not indicate is what was the role of the government and what was its responsibility under this act. And what at bottom, the responsibility of the government remains to inspect the house. The responsibility for the defects in that house must remain in the first instance on the private contractor. That's the person who builds the house, who supervises its construction and its placement.
Well, Mr.
into
Phillips,
the...
as I understand from Mr. Crowe's, one of the allegations in the complaint is that the government undertook to supervise and did so negligently.
All that the complaint says is that the government negligently supervised. It doesn't in any way indicate anything other than through the inspection process how that supervision could take place.
But, you know, you don't indicate that in a complaint under the federal rules. You can produce all sorts of evidence that will support simply conclusionary allegations in a complaint. You can't try the case in a complaint.
I appreciate that, Justice Rehnquist. But if the only supervision provided for in the regulations and provided for in any of the factual statements is the inspection of that house, then to say that there's been negligent supervision is to say no more than that there was a negligent inspection of the house. And that's all the complaint states. It doesn't say that we did anything in any way other than our inspection of the house.
Well, but if they say the allegations they could introduce in support of an allegation of negligent supervision go much further, I would think, than just negligent inspection.
Well, they couldn't. I mean, unless you're going to assume that there is something outside of the regulations, and there's no indication that anyone acted in addition to what the regulations
provide.
But the
case has never gone to trial.
I understand that, but there's never been any claim anywhere that difference.
Well, there's an allegation of negligent supervision in the.
Is there any allegation in the complaint that there was an obligation by contract or by statute or by regulation to supervise?
No, Your Honor. There's nothing in there to that effect. And the district court expressly found that there is no such obligation.
Yes, Mr. Phillips, but is it not true? There's a distinction between an obligation to supervise and the authority to supervise. And is it not true that the statute authorized the government to supervise?
It authorizes Secretary to provide for supervision.
Right. It says, statute specifically says, in addition to the financial assistance, this is Section 506, the Secretary is authorized to furnish various things, including construction supervision. And then the regulations say supervision will be provided borrowers to the extent necessary to achieve the objectives of the loan.
Yes, and that's and that
well, does
is
not that in words authorize the supervision.
Sure,
and if it's authorized, even if it isn't required.
That's correct, but
then if it's performed, it doesn't the Good Samaritan doctrine come into play?
Only to the extent that the only way the supervision is performed is through the inspection process. We don't, as I said earlier,
serve as the
foreman for the construction company.
The statute says authorized to provide construction supervision and inspection.
Yes, I appreciate what
things.
The statute says. All I'm saying
so
is that under the regulations,
authority to supervise.
Our regulations say that we will inspect, and that is done as
your
our
regulations say. You will supervise.
I'm sorry.
Your regulations say you will supervise.
To the extent necessary to help the borrower, which in this case means to undertake an inspection. That's the way I read them and understand the way the regulations work. respondent at the end of his remarks mentioned the administrative remedy one last time and suggested that there is no, that it's not intended as an exclusive remedy. Recognize that this case it turns exclusively on what Congress's intent is. And Congress has made clear what its understanding and intent under the Rural Home Loan Program would be. That is, that the program is designed to look just like the situation under the 1934 Act that was at issue in Neustadt. And it was because of Neustadt that Congress first enacted administrative relief for the FHA, extended it to the VA, and extended it to this statute. It was Congress's understanding that that's what the 1949 Act would lead to in terms of claims such as respondents in this case. And since it is this Court's interpretation of Congress's intent that controls, and the Sixth Circuit has disregarded that intent completely, we ask that its judgment be reversed.
Mr. Phillips, what is the specific provision in the agreement on which the claimant relied for the duty undertaken by the government? Is it the inspection of work section in the construction contract, Exhibit B? To the complaint.
You mean in her cause of action?
Yes.
For,
is
for,
that is yes, that ma'am. The section?
I believe that's the one that's mm-hmm. specified. Thank you.
Thank you, gentlemen. The case is submitted. We'll hear arguments next in.